Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review.
Hey guys, just a quick reminder, you are listening to the Elite Man Podcast. Throughout this episode, the word Giving Shy Guys Game Podcast may be referenced or referred to several times. These were just some of our earlier episodes, and I just wanted to remind you, you are still listening to the Elite Man Podcast. Okay guys, enjoy the show. On today's episode number 22, entitled Networking for Your Online Business, we chat with one of the best business minds in the world, Ted Rubin. Ted, thanks so much for coming on our show today, man.
Well, Justin, I'm really happy to be here. I'm a little confused by the name of the show, since you certainly don't seem shy. But then again, that's you reaching out to me via digital channel, so who knows?
Thanks, man. Can you tell our listeners a little more about your background and what exactly it is you do?
Well, sure. You know, if you bring it up to basically this time in 1997, I got involved in the digital world. I joined a company that was founded by Seth Godin. It was his first startup. And while I was there, he wrote his first bestseller called Permission Marketing. And I got a real education there. To keep it short, with Seth, it was an amazing place to work. He was an amazing guy to work with. I was lucky to have a lot of one-on-one time with him. Just a little note to the shy guys. If you ever get married, you move. And you end up in a place where your in-laws live and you left your family behind, don't ever move in with them. Under any circumstances, I don't care if you have to take a night job driving a freaking taxi, do what you got to do. Because although everything happens for a reason, and because I was living there, I made sure to get out of the house before anybody woke up. My ex-in-laws are like the Costanzas from Seinfeld, and all they do is yell at each other, and I couldn't stand to be there. So what that did was it got me in the office every morning, and I'm not an early riser, by 6:30 every morning, and the only other guy there was Seth. And being that I was the only other guy there, and he was really coming up with all these brilliant ideas, I was the guy that was fortunate enough to sit there and hear them. So I was there. It was Web 1.0, maybe even a little earlier. It was the first online direct marketing company. I'm actually the guy that sold the first click-throughs when no one knew what a click-through was. Everything was related to magazine and newspaper sales, so it was all CPMs. No one really understood digital. So it was a pretty cool time, and it's really where a lot of my thinking of how to connect with consumers, you know, Seth's ideas of permission marketing, which really meant more about building relationships with consumers. And it's really, I didn't start using the term return on relationship then, but it's really where the thinking kind of started. And then I just kind of moved my way through the web life. We got bought by Yahoo, where I worked for them for a while, went on to 800 Flowers when they were doing their underwriting, and then, you know, progressed through a couple of game companies, ended up at a place called Elf Cosmetics, which was basically online seller of cosmetics, inexpensive, trying to compete with the prestige brands by, you know, with claims of quality product. And they had no marketing budget. And it was kind of cool because they brought me in because I was a guy that wasn't afraid to come up with new ideas. I jumped with both feet, took them into social media, and built the largest presence for a cosmetics company in the early days when the big brands like Sephora and Estee Lauder, L'Oreal were afraid to be there. So it was kind of fun times. And then it progressed. I joined a social commerce company called Open Sky that was founded by a guy named John Kaplan, and then ended up at a company called, as a partner at a company called Collective Bias, where we created user-generated content in a storytelling format at scale. Left there, still a shareholder, last August of 2013. And now I'm out speaking. I'm finished my book, Return on Relationship. Wrote another one called How to Look People in the Eye Digitally, which is a lot about how to do what we do face-to-face when we do it well and take it to the online world so that we actually connect with people.
Cool. That's a great background. Sounds really interesting, too, to have in work with so many great people, and especially guys like Seth Godin and stuff, some of the really big name guys out there, some of the most intelligent people, I think, in my opinion, in the world. So it must have been a great learning experience as well.
It was, and Seth was a guy that liked to pass on, at least back then, a lot of what he was learning and and it was hands on. It wasn't just now he passed it all on by writing about it, by speaking about it. You know, I was lucky. I had a lot of direct one-to-one engagement.
So, as a CMO, what are some of your prime responsibilities, and what types of things do you do right now as a CMO?
Well, the good news is I'm not really a CMO anymore. And I say that's good news because CMOs have a, you know, CMO is a very difficult position. It's, I would think, probably one of the most fun positions in the company. But the problem is that you're not running sales, but you're responsible in a great deal for the sales that end up being for the company. So you're held accountable for a lot of things, but then you also don't get to oversee certain things. Like most companies, customer service doesn't come under the CMO, under the chief marketing officer. And for me, that's a huge disconnect because here you are building up a brand, telling customers what you believe in and what you're going to do for them. And then you have no say over the people that are actually there to do it for them when they have a problem, which is the most critical time. So, you know, right now I have a title of acting CMO, mainly because I'm with a company called Brand Innovators. They're a company that puts on marketing events all around the country for brand marketers and where they get to not only build a community, learn from each other, but also to meet vendors with products that they need to do their jobs. And right now, there's so many startups and so many companies in this space that most marketers are feeling overwhelmed. So what I see a lot of CMOs doing, and like I say, I don't have to do a lot of that because in the role that I'm doing, it's more about just doing high-level strategy and doing public appearances for them, mainly because they don't, as a company, as an events company, they don't have a lot of the day-to-day, real, true marketing activities that most product or packaged goods or service companies have because their marketing is mostly within their events. So, but what most CMOs are doing these days is they're trying to wrap their arms around the huge influx of data, which is overwhelming. And most of them are being pushed to use too much of it in too much of what I call a data-driven way and not a relationship or judgment-meaning way, meaning that data reads a certain way. But you need to be able to read into that data and understand it and then use it the way that's appropriate for your company to really make it worthwhile. And that's an incredibly hard thing to do. Another thing CMOs are doing right now is wading through all the different vendors that they need to talk to. With all the new products out there, the new platforms, all the different things we have to measure now. CMOs have a really, really incredible job. And you're reading a lot about that. A lot of them have to start understanding technology better. Most of them, and by the way, I don't blame them, don't really want to understand technology better. I mean, that's like a whole nother job. So there are a lot of them that are forging strong collaborations with their chief technology officers, with their chief information officers, educating those people more in what marketing means and how it relates to what they're doing in order to enlist their help to help the CMOs do their job so that they don't necessarily have to become that quite up to speed on the technology, the basis of it, how it works. Because if you have a CMO that's trying to vet products and he doesn't have a good working relationship with his CTO, who's going to have to tell him a few things. Number one, how that product works. Number two, how it integrates with what they're already doing from a technology standpoint, then that CMO is going to be at a big loss. So, and the CMO jobs, the third part of it that I think has become a big part is, again, forging those relationships with other peoples in the within the organization that you need now more than ever to be a part of your team and working with you.
Yeah, it's a great point you bring up. It's like a lot of the tech guys, so to speak, are great at like knowing the technology and all that and that aspect of it, but they're not necessarily great at the social aspect or forging relationships. And a lot of the, you know, the social guys, the relationship guys aren't necessarily great at the tech side, and it's something they have to kind of learn. You wrote a book about this kind of thing, Return on Relationships, the ROR. Can you talk about that a bit?
Okay, well, you know, just to break it down for you, Return on Relationship or ROR, or the hashtag I use is RONR for Return on Relationship, simply put, is the value that's accrued by a person or a brand due to nurturing a relationship. You know, ROI is simple dollars and cents. ROR is the value, both perceived and real, that will accrue over time through connection, loyalty, recommendations, and sharing. And, you know, for me, it's used to define and educate companies, brands, and people about the importance of creating authentic connection, you know, interaction and engagement. So if you break it down to simple words, take a part of what I just said, ROI is simple dollars and cents, then ROR is about the people. And what tends to get overlooked a lot is the people factor. You know, you're most brands are just looking at what can I throw at a company, especially retailers. What can I do online or offline that'll make this person walk out of the store with more product? And instead of looking at it from a relationship standpoint or from a lifetime value of a customer standpoint at this time, a lot of them are starting to look at it just on what can I drive like to them? What can I make them buy? What can I entice them with? Instead of what am I going to do to make their life better so they stay with me longer, so that they buy more product every time they're here, and so they do more business with me. And you know, what it really is that retail is coming full circle. There was a time when most retailers did that, meaning they looked at lifetime value of a customer. It was the most important number that a retailer or e-tailer could look at. How long will this person stay with me? And what I find today is I can't tell you how many companies I go into, and when I ask them that question, they don't have a clue. Because they're not really measuring it. They're so worried about today. They're so worried about next week. They're so worried about the click-throughs and the tracking from the first initial introduction to the consumer to the sale using digital channels that they're forgetting that there's a lot more to it than that. And I'll give you a classic example, and I don't know how familiar your audience is with, you know, certain advertising terminologies but there's something called retargeting. And what retargeting is a lot of companies are out there. Somebody abandons a shopping cart or they leave after they finish purchasing something. And if you can throw an ad at them or entice them with something and get them to come right back, then you can increase the order that they made. And the way most of these companies sell their product, and by the way, I don't blame them for selling it this way. It's a good sales tactic. If I was running their sales, I would do a lot of the same. Makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, yeah. You would have spent $5,000, you made $30,000. I'm just making up the numbers here. You know, I mean, any moron would say, hey, I'm going to start doing this. But what they're not looking at is the other side of the equation, the other 95% of the people who were pissed off that they got retargeted, who were annoyed that they got offered something after they left the store. They got annoyed that they got offered a discount as soon as they left the next time they come back instead of while they were. The point I was making is that you need to look at the relationship as a whole. You need to look at how you're connecting with people. It's not just about sales. I'm not saying in the end, here's a mistake that some people make when they talk to them. They think I'm saying that return on relationship is versus ROI or is more important than ROI. I am not saying that. Return on investment in the end is always the measure you have to go with. Even in personal relationships, you know, we all have only so many hours in a day or it's time. We base on the return we're getting. Whether, you know, on our investment in time versus the things that we're willing to dedicate ourselves to. What I'm saying is that if you focus on the people and you focus on the relationship first, it'll enhance return on investment in almost every case.
Your book,
How to Look People in the Eye Digitally.
Yeah, How to Look People in the Eye Digitally. Like, how can you apply some of those concepts to this as well?
Well, you know, first of all, How to Look People in the Eye Digitally is an extension of Return Relationship. It came out of that book. And what I've been saying for a while is that 2015 needs to be the year of looking people in the eye digitally. And my feeling is that the last few decades of marketing tactics have made us lazy communicators. Most often, we don't even pay attention to who we're talking to other than via the data we collect. And even that's a maybe. You know, and I think in order to fix this, we really need to start to benefit from social relationships, both as individuals and as companies. And we need to start looking people in the eye digitally. And what that means is paying attention to the people. It means to stop making excuses and start bringing in-person social skills to the digital world. And all the positive benefits are out there waiting. It's up to us to make them realize them. So, you know, whenever you're at an event or you're at a party or you're on a date or you're at an interview or you're a sales guy and you're meeting with someone, I mean, all the lessons are basically the same. Look at that person when they're talking to you. Pay attention to what they're saying to you. Sometimes repeat back some of the things they're saying so that they know that you're truly listening to them. Make remarks about things about them. Try to connect with them emotionally. I mean, when I was taught, whether it's a simple thing about going on a date, you know, tell the girl that you like what she's wearing, make a comment about something. There's a movie, American President, with Michael Douglas, and he's a president in office where his wife died, and he's going on his first date, and his daughter, who's a teenager, looks at him, and he's all nervous, and she says, Dad, tell her she has nice shoes. And he's like, he looks at her, he goes, what? She goes, tell her she has nice shoes. Every woman likes to hear that. And that's about connecting with somebody. So what did my dad teach me when I went on my first interviews, you know, and you, or when I went to make my first sales? Because I went on sales before interviews because I was selling stuff when I was a kid. I was one of those kids that sold a lot of different things. And my dad said, you know, anytime you go to see somebody, try to get there early. Walk around the neighborhood, you know, see what's happening out there. Get to know something that's relevant to them. If it's possible, get into their office. If there's any way to get their secretary or assistant or one of their coworkers to let you sit in their area or their office, you know, look at what's on the walls. If you can't do it beforehand, do it the minute you get in there with the person you're meeting. Look at the diplomas. Look at the photos. Where did they go to school? Do they like to fish? Do they have a favorite football team? Do they like to play golf? Do they have kids? Are they a grandparent, a parent? You know, anything that's in that room that can give you a point of connection, common ground. I mean, a lot of us do this naturally without even getting taught. You know, you meet somebody and what do you want you to do? If you want them to like you, then you try to find some kind of conversation that you can both talk about that makes sense. And what's happening is most of us have lost these skills online because everything has become so quick and so immediate. We click a button, we answer emails with one word, we answer texts, we don't even write the full word. You know, and what you need to start doing is start paying attention to what you're writing and who you're talking to. So if you follow me on Twitter, and I'm pretty damn active and I've got a lot of followers, I call everybody by name, anybody I respond to. I don't just respond unless I can't find their name. And very often, even if their name's not in their handle, I'll go into their blog. I'll look somewhere else. I'll try to find it and I'll call them by name. I'll mention something about the town they live in. If they live in Utah, I'll usually say something like, hey, I like to ski. I don't even have to say, hey, I noticed you live in Utah. I just say I like to ski and they know immediately what I'm referring to because why else would I have said that to them? Or I might make a mention of the, you know, if it's the winter and they're in Florida about, oh man, I wish I was, you know, down in some sunny weather or in some warmer weather. Or it's just a way to let people know that you're actually reading their bios, that you're reading the things they're putting out there, that you're paying attention. You know, I'm going to tell your audience the best social media book ever written. And none of them will guess it because it was not written by any of the social media pundits that are out there today. Not that a lot of them aren't brilliant because they are. But this was written by a guy in 1936. And it's more relevant today than it was the day it was written. And
I think I know what you're going to say.
I'm sure you do. It's called How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. I'm looking at the copy of the book right now sitting on my coffee table. I have an original copy that somebody found in a bookstore in London sitting up on my mantle who sent that to me. I have a copy on my iPod, and I mean on my iPad, and a copy on my iPhone. So I can refer to it all the time because the tips in there are more relevant and more valuable today than the day it was written, because back when it was written, maybe you'd come in contact with 100 people over the course of your career or the course of your years. Now you'll come in contact with tens of thousands. It can be in a matter of hours. And there's so many people you can affect by making it about them, by asking questions that are important, by using their names. The sound of someone's name is the most beautiful sound in any language to that person. And these are simple things to do, but they do take time. I mean, I say even do it in emails. I do it a lot in text. Now, not when I'm busy and I'm running and you and I are having a back and forth about where to meet. But if you just text me out of nowhere and say, hey, Ted, you know, looking forward to getting on a podcast next week, or hey, thanks for that, there's a good bet that I'm going to write back and say, my pleasure, Justin. And it's as simple as that. Now, what did I do? I wrote, six extra letters. It isn't that hard to do. And when I reply to emails very often, and I have to think about it myself. I'll start writing an email. I'll be about to send it. And then I'll realize I didn't put the person's name in it. And I'll take 2 seconds and I'll just add their name, either the beginning or the end. You know, like, hey, Justin, instead of, you know, hey, I got this done. Hey, Justin, I got this done. People appreciate that. And what it is that some of them will notice it like off and make a mention of it. The majority will never mention it, but they feel it and it means something to them. And the way you can really notice it is when you see a certain percentage of them start doing it back to you. It's really cool. That means that it really hit them, that they appreciated it and they want to give you the same respect.
Carnegie even says that in his book, the number one thing that people cherish the most is their name. So
right.
I think it's a great point that you make that and using their name, even in social media and in the digital age that we live in now, is so important and actually probably now more than ever, just because So many people aren't doing that. So you're definitely going to stick out when you do start to do things like that.
Justin, that's a great. I just want to harp on that point for a second because you just made a really important point. You know, I hear so often about, well, no one else is doing that. Well, that's probably the most valuable reason for you to do it, because mm-hmm. it'll make you stand out. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. And I'm sure you've noticed this, but social media is catching on a lot more than it ever was. And most companies are, I would say the majority are not necessarily doing it right. Or I think doing it right is the wrong expression, aren't necessarily leveraging it to their best advantage. But there are a lot of companies starting to get the relationship thing and the connection and the answering and the responding. But have you noticed that they all do it on Twitter? They've decided that Twitter is the communication platform, but none of them do it on Facebook. I'm at events. I challenge anybody in the audience to tell me one major company that's on Facebook that responds to people that make comments, that likes things, that when they make comments in their feed, that ever goes back to those people's pages and likes something on their page, you know, using their employees to do it or anything like that. They're not doing it. And when a company says to me, well, you know, that's because Twitter's for that, and we're, you know, and a lot of the experts say Facebook's not the place for it. I said, that's why it's the perfect place for it. How would you like, well, every time I'm in an event and I say, does anybody know a company? There's always someone that raises their hand and says, yes, I do. And they name your company. You made a really valid point. That goes for people and individuals too. When you do things that others aren't doing, it makes you stand out and it makes you noticeable. And that's how you build a personal brand. Because I like to say that a brand is what a business or a person does. A reputation is what people remember and share.
Right, man. We kind of touched on it a bit right there, and I was actually meaning to bring it up, but what are your thoughts on kind of the Facebook versus Twitter for business comparison? Like, which do you think is better, or like what kind of strategies can you implement in each one?
Well, I don't think there's a better. I think there's a couple of questions that go in. Number one is what's your budget and manpower? You know, if you're a large Fortune 500 company, you have no business not being on every platform. I mean, you really don't. You need to see. Now, granted, if none of your audience is on a platform and you're really finding nobody there, then fine. It's not a place to be. But and granted, you know, Pinterest isn't for everybody. You know, it's a discovery platform. It's really good for certain types of products. Obviously, it's all about women. But Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, I mean, LinkedIn, there's almost no excuse not to be there. And they all serve different purposes. But in the end, to me, what they're all there to do is to give you the opportunity to reach out, connect, engage, and build relationships and an emotional connection with your consumer. And look, Twitter, what the beauty of Twitter is, you can grow your following aggressively. And there's no, as long as you follow the rules, which are pretty easy to do, you don't get punished for it. And there's nobody out in the world that says, oh my God, I hate those guys. They're following everybody just to get them to follow back. I don't hear anybody say that except the people that are just maybe annoyed or jealous that they have a big follower. You know, whereas on Facebook, it's absolutely not only not allowed by Facebook, but it's frowned upon by the community. Like, people don't want to be friended by people that absolutely don't know them, and it's or encouraged to follow things. I mean, as long as there's a reason, but it's not as easy to go out and aggressively grow a following. You know, Instagram is somewhat similar to Twitter, but like on Facebook, I mean, I've been to events where I've literally met 300 people. And I've come back and tried to friend them, and Facebook has cut me off after friending 50 of them, saying because they weren't connected to me in any way. You know, if I try to friend someone who has six of the same friends as me, Facebook doesn't have a problem. But if all of a sudden I go to an event, and this has happened to me, where it's an event totally out of my realm. You know, it's some place where the people I go don't know any of the people I know. So all of a sudden I've got cards and I've sat down and spoken to a few hundred people that I've never met before that don't know any of my friends. Facebook will make it very difficult for me to friend all of them. Now, they also give me the opportunity to answer that question, which I have on occasion, and they've accepted my answer. I've written back and said, I just spoke at this conference. I met all these people. And then they stopped blocking me. But they're pretty aggressive that way. So Twitter's great for aggressively growing a platform. Twitter's also great because it's a news medium. It's a place where people are going for real-time information. It's a very easy engagement, conversational type of platform. There's a lot lower expectations there of the quality of the content, meaning that, you know, you can write something in 120 characters and it can be short, but if it makes a statement, people are like, that's fine. You know, very often if you're a brand and you're doing that on Facebook, they're going to say, why am I coming here? Whereas, so on Facebook, for me, it's a little bit more longer form content. Photos are much more important. I mean, they will tell you on Twitter that, a lot of tweets with photo content get more engagement. But I think that's also about value, I think, because a lot of the tweets without photos from some of these people aren't being written really well, or a lot of them are just retweets or repurposed content rather than real thought-provoking content. So on Facebook, you know, you need more of a story. You need more about photos. Links to articles do really well. You also get a very different type of conversation going. It's not a one-to-one conversation. It's a whole. It's usually a group that are commenting to each other. And so I think I get a lot of value out of both. I think companies need to be in both places. Again, it all depends on what you're selling and what you're doing. Some B2B companies, Facebook might not be the place to be, but LinkedIn is much more valuable. And then I look at LinkedIn as much more of a more serious content type of platform. It's a place where people go for learning rather than entertainment. And granted, for some people, learning is entertainment. For some people, you know, reading articles about current trends and the market and marketing and business, you know, is entertainment. But that's not what I'm talking about when I say entertainment. You know, I'm talking about, you know, the difference between entertainment where you're sitting back and just watching, and then something where you're learning something that you're adding to your educational or business repertoire. And I think that LinkedIn is an amazing place. I don't think I take enough advantage of LinkedIn. It's one of the places I'm trying to spend more time. I publish a lot there, but I don't go there enough and interact and engage as much as I'd like to. So I'm trying to up my game with that. And then last one I want to mention is Google Plus. It to me is not a social platform, but you really do need to keep it as part of your, like anything you're publishing, blog content, post to social that are informational. You got to make sure just to post it to Google Plus just because of the way Google indexes there. Because they favor Google Plus for index. So if you post your content to Google Plus and then one plus your own content, it'll help you in search,
author rank, etc., stuff like that.
Right.
I agree. They all have their place. Facebook certainly has its stronghold and its place. And Twitter actually over the last few months I've really grown to love and actually kind of start using even a little more than Facebook just because of that, as you mentioned, like connectivity, and it's easier to just kind of casually connect to people, and you find that people kind of comment back a lot more on posts and stuff like that on Twitter when you get like good content up there.
Yes, but it's a lot more immediate. Plus, you know, one last thing that I kind of implied but I didn't come right out and say is to be more specific, it really depends on your company, you know, and your consumer. And really important is you need to be where your consumer is. And that's one of the reasons I say you have to be in a lot of places, because, you know, if you're a small business or a small to medium-sized business or a larger business that's just getting into social and, you know, you do have a budgetary problem, then you have to just decide where the most of your consumers are and where you can get the most bang for your buck. But here's a really important point. Don't be there if you're not going to be social. So don't let some expert or guru or someone in your company say, hey, we have to be, you know, I was on this podcast and Ted Rubin said, oh, we have to be on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or Pinterest, unless you can be there to communicate. So to have a presence but do nothing, or be there and people reach out to you and you don't reach back, that is incredibly bad. So what I say is, if you don't have those budgets, pick the one or two places you can make the difference. You can dedicate the time and put in your time there, and don't spread out to the other places until you have time to dedicate the resources to it. And the last thing I'd like to say is that if you're a small business or if you're an individual who hasn't done much with social, to me the easiest place to start is Instagram. Because creating content is so incredibly easy. It's as simple as pointing your camera or your phone and going click, 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 click. That's content, 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 content. And from Instagram, you can syndicate content to Tumblr, Foursquare, Facebook, Twitter, Flickr, all at the click of a button. And because it's images, it works everywhere. So that's a really easy place to get started.
All right, guys. I think it's the perfect time to take a quick break from the episode to remind you to subscribe to our show. By subscribing, you get every single episode completely free. That's right, get all of our best interviews with the best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and entrepreneurial worlds absolutely free. Don't miss out on any one of our captivating and exciting episodes. Subscribe now and get all of the Elite Man Podcast anytime and anywhere. And yes, if you get a chance, leave us a glowing review about how much you love the show and how awesome we are. Okay, guys, back to the episode now.
Can you talk a little about how you grew such a huge following on your Twitter platform and even building up your brand, TedRubin.com?
A lot of hard work. I mean, no, seriously, people think it's just, it not only is it a lot of hard work, but it's constant work. Like I never, when I, from the moment I got on Twitter in 2008, I recognized the power of it. And someone had to talk me into going on it. And there's a guy named Oz Sultan. He's a consultant out there. He's been around the industry for a lot of years. And I was introduced to him, by a friend named Roger Hollander, when I was at Elf Cosmetics. And I recognized that I needed help before I started doing a lot of the things I was looking to do on the social channels, for Elf Cosmetics. And I spent a lot of time with Oz, who is a brilliant guy and gave me a lot of insight into a lot of the different platforms and gave me a lot of my original thinking. And then when I said to him, I'm just not quite getting this Twitter, he said, you know, Roger's a great guy. He sent me back to the guy that sent me to him. He said, you should have dinner with Roger, let him walk you through. And the two of them kind of gave me my first view into it. And then literally I went back, I was playing with it and it just clicked. And I said, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, look at all these people I could reach. I can write in sentences, which, you know, I'm a frustrated author. I've written a couple of books, but they're both short form. They're 100-something pages. I don't like writing that way. When I started my blog, a mentor of mine said, you have to have a blog. And I argued with him because I didn't want to do it. And he said, listen, just do it. And I said, well, I don't write that way. He says, listen, you'll learn to. It's like running and drinking. You start running, you start drinking, you don't do it too well. You do it a lot, you do it a lot better. and you know, so I got obsessed with Twitter. And I realized what I could do with it. And then I had what a lot of people have is I said, oh, damn, I wish I'd gotten on this sooner. And what that meant to me was I didn't want to waste any more time. And really, since 2008, there's not a day or week that's gone by that I haven't worked on growing my presence, following people to get them to follow me, unfollowing people that don't follow me. My hashtag for return relationship R on R. And as I saw how that gained traction and helped me build my brand, I started using other hashtags that were relevant to what I was doing. So I'm pretty well known for the hashtag just be nice. It's something I started using. I have a Twitter handle. Somebody had just be nice. So I have just underscore the letter B underscore nice, NICE. Then I started using a hashtag no let up. Because I believe there's just – buddy of mine has this thing called No Let Up. He has these bracelets and sweatshirts he gave me. And I really like wrapped – he was an old friend of mine who knew a lot of what I'd been through, what he'd been through. And, you know, I just believe none of us – there's nothing we can let up on. It's never easy. And that started catching on. And then, you know, I'm a dad who had to fight to keep his kids in his life. And that battle never ends. So I started This Dad Won't Quit. And I have a handle, This Dad Won't Quit. And, you know, a lot, some of these things have taken on lives of their own. Some of them, you know, my mom passed away this past month. And thank you. And it was a tough month, but we were very lucky. My mom was in hospice and we got to spend about 6 or 7 days with her, fully aware, having great conversations. And I was sharing a lot of it socially with my followers in the world. And I'm a big believer that there's no line between personal and business anymore. And people want to know who you are as people and they relate to that. And I started a hashtag when she passed, rest in peace, Bernice, RIP Bernice. And people jumped all over it. You know, and I said, this is a short term thing. It's for a few weeks, it's to honor my mom. And, you know, I just find so much value there. Hashtags have become the water cooler of the world where people gather to have conversations. And between Instagram and even – and more so Twitter, those conversations gain a life. So that's how I've done it. And then most importantly is provide good content. I mean, people come to my Twitter handle because I give them information in short form. I have a lot of CEOs and CMOs that say to me that they come check my Twitter handle before meetings so they can throw out a couple of one or two one-liners and sound like they're smart to their teams. You know, just, you know, they're joking with me, but they're also serious because things like, you know, relationships are like muscle tissue. The more you engage them, the stronger and more valuable they become. Brands, you know, a brand is what you do. A reputation is what people remember. Less fabrication, more facilitation. Real Trump's perfect. I mean, this is the age of influence where anybody can build a brand, affect change, make a difference without ever leaving their bedroom. I mean, these things are things that have caught on. But I've also made sure to take the things I've written, put them in a form and content that people could easily share so that they want to keep coming back. Anybody that reaches out to me, I reach back. Anybody that makes a personal tweet to me or direct message, they hear from me. And people that retweet me, I can't these days. I can't reach out to everybody because it's gotten a little bit too extensive. But I do my best to reach out to as many as I can. And people know that if they do it multiple times, they're definitely bound to hear from me with a thank you, with something. But if they communicate with me, if they reach out and ask me something, they will always hear back from me.
Awesome, man. Ted, just a few more questions and then we do kind of wrap things up. But Ted, what would you, if you had to whittle it down to just one thing, what would you say is the most important thing to try to focus on? Is it like SEO, content marketing, creating relationships, networking, or something else?
Be who you are and say what you feel, because those who mind don't matter and those who matter don't mind. Now, I'm not the genius that wrote that. Dr. Seuss is. and it's one of the things that I've always told my daughters, and I'll tell anybody that's listening to this, is that, you know, the word authenticity has gotten a bad rap lately because people say it's being used too much. But the truth is, if you're really yourself, if you say what you're thinking, first of all, you don't have to think about it. You don't have to remember what you said because you're not making something up. You're not trying to be somebody you're not. Be yourself and be passionate and share it with people. And connect with them. I mean, I'm giving you a bunch of things, but you know that's what I think is the most important thing. And in the end, it's focus on the people.
Awesome, man. That's good. I really like it. A quick question: how do you go about getting like something like media coverage, getting coverage for your site, getting people to basically want to promote you or something? Is it as simple as just asking for it, or is there something more to it?
Truth be told, I don't believe in the asking for it thing. You ask people about me, very few will tell you that I've asked them to do things for me. Matter of fact, when my mom passed and I asked people to use the Rest in Peace Bernice hashtag, it was probably the first thing I asked for in so many years, and that's why so many people jumped on it. And people are always saying, what can I do for you? I believe, and I've been trying to prove this out a lot, and I'm not saying it's the best method. I think there are people out there that ask for things that maybe get a lot more, earn a lot more, make it happen faster, but I believe you can make it happen organically by creating good content, by featuring other people. I'm always sharing other people's stuff. I'm always going out there. If you do for others without expectation of anything directly in return, they will do for you. They can't help themselves. Pick somebody in your office that you know does not like you. You just know it. You know, I don't mean that person that hates you and badmouths everybody. I'm talking about the guy that you know just, you know, he'd rather not chat with you. He doesn't have a lot to do with you. He doesn't listen much to your ideas. And every day for the next 2 weeks, bring him a cup of coffee in the morning or something that you know he likes. Tea, coffee with cream, whatever, you know, something that you can bring to his office every single day. And I guarantee you, he will feel compelled to do something nice for you back, even if he doesn't like you. So, you know, it's to me is if you create really good content, if you share other people's content aggressively and get a reputation for always doing for others, for any time someone reaches out to me, Ted, can you share this for me? Sure. Ted, can you do this? My pleasure. You know, again, as long as it's like, I don't like, if it's a brand, I'll do it maybe once or twice. Then I'll say, dudes, like, you know, this is what I do for a living. I've had serious big companies think that they can just keep asking you for something for free. But I'm talking about for people, especially, and if you want to get journalists' attention, start going to their Twitter handles and retweeting them. Anybody who you want to pay attention to you, start sharing their content. They will notice you. And then, you know, it goes back to a question you asked earlier about growing a large presence. The larger your Twitter following or your Facebook following or your Instagram following or anything, the more people are going to appreciate it when you share their content, because they're going to say, oh my, they're going to come and look. Like if Justin shares some writer stuff 10 times, eventually he's going to go, who is this guy? You know, this guy Justin keeps popping up in my feed. He's sharing my stuff. And then he goes to your Twitter feed. He goes, oh, wow, this guy's got 25,000 followers. And he gets and every time he shares my stuff, it gets retweeted. You know, I should look a little deeper. And then make sure that you've got a great bio, that you've got information that's valuable, that people can get in touch with you, that your phone number, your email, and other things are there. That any other, like if you go to my Twitter page, you'll see all my other Twitter handles listed on the background on the page. You'll see my Facebook and my LinkedIn. It gives people access to finding me, to knowing who I am, to getting in touch with me. Make it easy for them. And then do for them. And you'll find that people will start recognizing you. And then goes back to the question, if you create good content, If you're unique, if you speak your mind, people are going to want to share your stuff. It makes you unique. It makes you stand out.
That might be the best single piece of advice I've heard as far as getting people to do something for you, is to just first, you know, kind of do something for them, and without wanting something in return, but just be open to giving yourself and helping them out first. And obviously they're going to just naturally return the favor. It's kind of human nature.
100%. I like to say, start friend them before they be their friend, before you expect them to be your friend.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
You know, the only way to only way to make a friend is to be a friend, and that's Emerson. Again, I'm not the genius. When they're mine, I take credit for them. When they're not, I don't. So I like to say to brands need to attract customers, but breaking through the clutter is challenging. Stand out by liking them before they like you.
Absolutely. What's the single best piece of advice for young online entrepreneurs, like trying to start a blog, online business, et cetera?
Well, the first thing I would say, which is leading off of what we just talked about, is look at your own behaviors and ask yourself, would I want to be my friend? Would I want to support me? Because bottom line is, you know, look, there's a lot of ideas out there, and there are very few geniuses who come up with that one idea. That's the groundbreaker. Most ideas take off because somebody supported it in the early days, because somebody liked you enough or wanted to support you because they said, hey, I like this guy, Justin. He's got a great idea. Or, yeah, you know, I've heard a lot of these, but let's give Justin. And then all of a sudden it catches on. I mean, you know, Snapchat wasn't some brilliant idea. Twitter wasn't even started to be what it is. I mean, they never had this vision for the company. They started doing something to communicate with people, to keep it easy. It was 140 characters because of restrictions that had something to do with, and I'm so far from being a technologist that I don't really know the details of this, but it was some kind of a restriction on how many characters it could be because of the way the data is transferred. And, you know, people started supporting it. Somebody liked it. I mean, Snapchat is no brilliant idea. It's just something that caught on against 1,000 other things that people tried, but there were people that supported it in the beginning, and I would say probably because the guy that started it had a decent network to begin with. So, you know, I mean, look where Facebook started. I mean, yes, the guy is a genius, but he started it at Harvard in a place where there was a unique group, and then it went to universities where people supported it because it was started by kids at a university before it grew out to what it was. There was local support for it. There was support because of where it came from. There was support because people liked the people.
Ted, is it better? It's kind of a debate going on in, I'd say, like the business community. Is it better to brand yourself or brand a company?
Well, I think that everybody should be branding themselves. I'm not saying it's not better one or the other. You should definitely brand a company when you have a company. But every company should be empowering their employees to brand themselves. Because the bigger those people's brands are, the more powerful the company is as a whole. So everybody should have a personal brand. Now, if you're the kind of guy that Steve Jobs and Apple, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, who are so intertwined in their businesses, but there aren't a lot of people like that. I mean, even a lot of guys that do startups, you know, they're serial entrepreneurs. They start 10 different companies. They don't necessarily want to brand themselves around one business because it's like an actor who gets caught up in a certain type of role who can't break out of it. So I think personal branding is definitely more important.
Definitely, man. Is there any final message, takeaway, kind of send off you'd like to leave our listeners?
Absolutely. You know, and it was something I said earlier that I want to repeat now. Relationships are like muscle tissue. The more you engage them, the stronger and more valuable they become. Live that with your life, and I guarantee you, you'll prosper.
Thanks a lot, man. It's great.
My pleasure.
And where can our listeners find more about you, Ted?
Well, I'm real easy to find. Just Google Ted Rubin. Everything that comes up on about the first five pages is me, other than the 97-year-old Medal of Award winner from World War II. That's not me. But I'm at Ted Rubin on Twitter. I have about 10 other Twitter handles. You can find them at Ted Rubin if you go to twitter.com. I am Ted Rubin on Facebook, Ted Rubin on Instagram, Ted Rubin on LinkedIn, Ted Rubin USA on YouTube, and TedRubin.com is my blog, and returnonrelationship.com is my other website. So feel free to reach out to me anywhere. It's TedRubin@gmail.com, and my phone number is 516-270-5511.
Thanks, Ted. Guys, please check him out. Again, it's tedrubin.com. You can Google him, Twitter handle, Facebook, YouTube. The guy's everywhere. literally one of the best minds, one of the best business minds in the world. So much great advice from Ted today. And if you get a chance, please check him out. Ted, thanks so much again for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. It's been an absolute great time having you on, man. And hope to talk to you soon.
You got it, man. Reach out anytime.
Alright guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing, you get every single episode completely free. That's right, get all of our best interviews with the best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and entrepreneurial worlds absolutely free. Don't miss out on any one of our captivating and exciting shows. Subscribe now and get the Elite Man podcast anytime and anywhere. And yes, if you get a chance, leave us a glowing review about how much you love the show and how awesome we are. All right, guys, that's it. Until next time, take care.